Good morning. This is Donald Smith. We're here in Stuyvesant Falls at the home of Dr. Ken Gumaire, class of 1943. Also here is Dr. Richard Drum, class of 1951. We're here to record some of the experiences of Dr. Gumaire. Good morning, Ken. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mark. It's nice to have you visit me. As usual, you've been very kind to me. I remember when my wife passed away, you came all the way down here from Ithaca to attend the services. I've been very appreciative of and impressed by it. I thought that was going the extra mile. You did a beautiful service there.
Would you like to tell us about your experience in veterinary college and after you graduated? Just tell us whatever you'd like to, Ken.
Well, I entered Cornell in 1937 as a two-year ag student. My primary goal had always been to get into veterinary medicine, and I was trying to accomplish that. And I did very well scholastically, and I was requested to plan my curriculum to do work in research. They wanted me to work with the agricultural department. I thought, well, if I think I could get into graduate school in agriculture, in the ag school, I ought to be able to get into veterinary college. And I went to the admissions, and they suggested I go to Syracuse University during the summer session and took some courses in physics and to qualify to be acceptable as a candidate for veterinary college, and I was accepted, fortunately. That was my goal in life, was to get into veterinary college. And starting as a freshman in the veterinary college, I had a problem with finances, and I worked my way through pretty much completely. I had saved up $700 as a pre-vet. And that, along with WPA and the work that they gave available to students at that time, which I paid $1 an hour, it seems to me it was a pretty high wage in those days. But I worked my way through school, and I got a job with Dr. Peter Olson there in the postmortem room. That was at the time they converted into a new laboratory there at the Moore Building. And that was a beautiful setup. They had such a contrast from the old sheds where they had the wooden tables to do all the autopsies. I took a lot of pride in trying to keep that place in good shape. I gained all the extra knowledge of going over all the material that was left at the end of the day to be able to make a good review of the pathologic changes in these animals. And so it was an opportunity that gave me a good head start in my academic work. And I worked there till I graduated from college. Well, actually, I was in the first accelerated program. That was during the onset of the war, World War II. And so they accelerated our class through one summer session, and we graduated in January of that year. I got a job with Dr. Dimmick, W.W. Dimmick, at the University of Kentucky as an assistant pathologist, which was a very good opportunity. But I had taken ROTC, and I had a reserve commission in the infantry. And unfortunately, after I'd been at the University of Kentucky for 7 months, I got called to active duty. And they assigned me to the veterinary pool at Brooklyn Army Base in New York City. And unfortunately, that was a step towards my goal, but it wasn't the kind of a job that I liked, doing meat inspections and that sort of thing, and food inspections and butter inspections on the New York market for the Army. And so another veterinarian there from Pennsylvania, Dr. Waple, And I saw there was an ad on the notice on the bulletin board requesting volunteers for combat tactical dangerous mission. And they sent us directly then to Remount Training School in Fort Robinson, Nebraska. And we were assigned to Quartermaster Pack Troops. I was assigned to the 31st Quartermaster Pack Troop, and he was assigned to the 33rd. That was in Fort Bliss, Texas. So we were assigned brand new shipment of mules and brand new Liberty ships and to transport them over to the area of combat training under General. But he was a commander of that Remount Depot. They had 20,000 head of mules there. So it was a real intense opportunity to get to do some training there. We departed with our mules. I had 260-some head of mules on board the brand new Liberty ship. And there was about the number of troops in the quartermaster pack troop itself was about, there was probably about 60 soldiers in as a quad that made up the pack troop. And these guys, most of them, they were volunteers too, and a lot of them came from Guadalcanal and had quite a bit of combat experience, so they were well qualified. We joined up in India, Deogarh, India, with the British, to train with the British Chindits. They were the British Indian troops that were doing the fighting over there in North Burma at that time against the Japanese invasion into Burma and India.
They had a little trouble with the boat going over.
Oh yeah, going over. We were 3 days out of New Orleans, Louisiana. The boat was hit by a torpedo, but they had devised a device inside of the ship to cancel out the damage that the torpedo would do to the ship. And that was just off the coast of Key West, Florida. We got hit by that thing at night, and it didn't sink the boat, but the concussion from all the detonating of those torpedoes caused the castings on the drive shaft all fractured, and the boat lost complete power. It happened at night, of course. It was one of those nights when the clouds were over, and every once in a while the sky would clear up, and there'd be a lot of moonlight. So it was ideal for the German subs were doing a lot of damage off the coast of U.S. at that time, particularly down that area. They sent out an SOS and they sent PBY planes over to scare the subs away. And then they sent an ocean-going tug in to pick us up, and they hooked onto us and towed us into the port there, into Miami. And so we spent a week in Miami getting major repairs there, with the mules still on board. And then from there we went to Newport News, which was for major to get the final repairs. But since we had a pitch manure over every night, they didn't want us in the convoy. So we had to go over without a convoy.
Across the Atlantic.
Across the North Atlantic. And then we were, I think, one of the first to go through the Suez Canal. Fortunately, there was a real bad northeaster, a lot of storm, the ocean was real rough, so there was very little opportunity for a sub to operate, so we were lucky that way. We didn't get any torpedo activity going across. The mules were put on top of the deck covers in the hold, and then there's another bunch put on deck, on the top of the deck. They made shades for them, so they were stapled in those sheds on the upper deck. Soldiers would take them down and exercise them on the deck boards down below. So they did get some exercise. Unfortunately, it should have been a couple week trip. It took us 87 days from the time we loaded in West Wego, Louisiana, where we left departing from, till we got to Calcutta. It took 87 days to get to Calcutta, India, with those mules. And going across all that rough sea caused a lot of trauma hematomas were very common. We had some massive hematomas, some as big as wishbone baskets. And Captain Craig, who was our troop commander, told me, he says, if you can get those mules in active duty shape when we get into Calcutta, he said, I'm going to put you in for a commendation. But unfortunately, he got killed during the campaign. And the mules really did well because they had a couple of weeks to recoup, and we were able to drain most of those big hematomas. And we lost one mule on that whole trip due to a fractured femur. He got down and got his leg in, caught in the sideboard. So we had one mule pitch overboard. But when we got into Calcutta to unload mules, it was interesting. There was all the native British Indian forces had fled the area. It was pretty much abandoned. So there was nobody there to help us unload the boat. We had to put them on small boxcars and train. And took a train trip to Deogarh, where we trained with the British Chindits.
How did you get them off the boat to the boxcars?
They had slings, and then dropped them on the shore. Four of them we put in each one of those cars, and we had to take bamboo poles and cut them and make, just pry them in between the sides of the boxcars, and had four mules, two on each side, head to head. It was quite a train trip to take them from there to Deogarh. It took several days to get there. And we got there just as the troops were getting ready to move down the trail. Unfortunately, I got dysentery bad, real bad. We didn't have any American medics with us. A British Indian officer, took me off and dropped me off at one of their Indian hospitals there for a day, and I got behind the compound, and I got over that. All in all, we went right from there right into combat, behind the Jap lines, and it was a real surprise. I don't think the Japs expected our troops to be so experienced, and they killed a lot of the soldiers that were used to frontal assault. They just walked right into the fire. We had Japanese interpreters with us, and they were very, very patriotic and very loyal to the group, and they got us a lot of good information, which made it a lot easier for us to know what to expect in that kind of warfare. In a tight jungle, you're more or less confined to the trails. To get out into the jungle is just almost impossible. You have to cut down all the bamboo and stuff.
How long were you in combat on that trail?
We got over there, matter of fact, on Christmas Eve, 43. And then we got into Mitchell in 44. I've got a picture of one of the guys that was taken at the same time I was going down into Mitchell. He was an infantry. He was one of our heroes. He killed quite a few Japs, and he got shot, hit with a bullet in the wrist. His wristwatch and spattered metal all over his face, and they reported him as being killed in action, and his folks didn't know about it for a month that he was still alive.
You were afflicted with anthrax.
Yeah, well, that happened after the campaign was over, when we were going. I was then assigned as a liaison officer with the Chinese Animal Transport. General Chiang Kai-shek was our commander. He was on that trip taking mules into China.
Were these the same mules that you had taken across on the boat?
Well, what were left of them, yeah. Oh. There was a high rate of casualties. The biggest problem, most of them that survived had SURA so bad, and I don't think the Army really was aware of how severely diseased they were.
Tell us about the anthrax situation.
Well, I was accompanying the Chinese, and we're getting into the native. This was going back over the old Burma Road back into China from Burma. The trails were very treacherous, and they were more or less on the top of the peaks. So there was villages along the way. The Chinese soldiers, particularly the officers, they liked to bivouac in the villages, put their horses, their mounts, in these native barns. And one morning they came out and the officer came over to me and his horse was dead by autopsy. And he had typical edema with the spleen in the celiac area. And so I got a blood sample and took it to, there was an army ordnance outfit on the road and they had a medic attached to that, and I got them to make a smear of it, and it was loaded with sporulated rods, and so they had me go immediately as fast as you could. There's no way you'd get an airplane, so we drove on the Jeep. And got there at night into Kunming to the general hospital, and they were supposedly had treatment for anthrax, but the treatment at that time was anti-anthrax antiserum, equine origin, and they only had one dose of the serum. So he said, there's no use of giving you that, because he said, it takes several treatments to be effective. So they entered me into the isolation there. Actually, it was right next to the morgue there in the hospital. And they put me on penicillin every 4 hours. That was before penicillin had been ever therapeutically used for treating anthrax.
That was aqueous.
Aqueous, yeah. Of course, they used moist packs, and I think probably peroxide or something like that. And because I had the cutaneous form of anthrax. It creates boils, but they have big black scabs on them, and they're hard. They keep discharging, and they don't heal. And but by putting these moist packs around my wrist, it started to regress right away with the penicillin. And so I was only there a couple of weeks, and I got discharged. I was an interesting specimen. All the personnel at the hospital were coming over looking at the lesions. Fortunately, they did the right thing. I got the lesion on my wrist from blood gut on my. I wore rubber gloves, but they weren't the full length ones. And blood got onto my sleeve on my field jacket. And rubbing over my wrist apparently started that infection. But it's very contagious.
So you came home shortly after you were discharged?
I was over there for over 2 years. But I didn't come home immediately after the campaign was over. I was put as a liaison officer with the Chinese. But we didn't come home until after the bomb went off and the war ended, and then we came home. We were supposed to come home earlier based on our time being there, but they were so short of personnel that nobody got out of there. It was quite a bit of controversy about that. A lot of the guys they sent when they came out of the hospitals, they were still not battle ready, but they sent them back, and that created quite a bit of discord between the General Stillwell and local officers. Now, General Murrow was our commanding officer. He was a very soft-spoken guy from New Hampshire. He was a New Englander, but he was a West Point graduate, and he was very knowledgeable guy. But you wouldn't expect him to be that kind of a combat officer. He had willpower and guts to stick with it, and made the final march down over the mountain back into Michinaw.
How did he treat you as a veterinarian?
Well, actually, he had a heart attack shortly after I joined the unit. When I came there with mules at Deagar to train with him, he was right there to greet us all, and he actually gave each one of the officers a bottle of red whiskey. And of course, we shared it with the group. It was a good cordial meeting. But he was a very soft-spoken guy.
And you came back to the States and practiced.
Yeah, I had picked up scrub typhus while I was here, so I was recuperating from that. And they put me on a Governor's Island in the hospital. I was there for a couple months. Until I got rid of all the associated parasites. I had dysentery and hookworm. From there, I worked as a field veterinary for the veterinary college, and then I went into practice. I was in the reserves for about 6 months, but I didn't go on any active duty.
And later you worked for Stirling Laboratories.
Well, I practiced for about 15 years in Rhinebeck. And I did start out in mostly large animal. There were a lot of Angus there in that area, and a lot of truck horses, work horses, Clydesdales, and they were more or less show herds, but there were a lot of them there, and I used to make the fair circuits with all of them, and so they were quite popular. But then after being there for that length of time, I was developing a lot of back trouble. My local practitioner told me I should get out of the large animal business and not do any more of that heavy footwork that I was doing a lot of. After I got out, I went to the hospital, and they found out that I had the gout. And it was primarily the gout that was causing all the acute pains. In the meantime, they had done back surgery on me, which was didn't cure anything. But I did go to the hospital down in New York, and I spent a month down there. They did a fusion, and so I was tied up for a while. After I got that word from my doctor to get out of the large animal business, I went and sold my practice and took a job with Stirling Winthrop Research Institute. That was in 1960, I think. That's when I left Rhinebeck and went to Stirling. And I worked there for 15 years before I retired. But I was a pathologist with Stirling Winthrop.
You're a foremost benefactor of Cornell University. What does that mean to you?
Well, I always wanted to improve the environment for veterinary practice for all veterinarians. Cornell had been so gracious to me. I feel their training and salvaging me by giving me the opportunity to get that education. I was able to put some of my benefits back into the college. I was very grateful to Cornell for all that they did and for the good work that the professors did to make us all well-trained. We had the opportunity, and I just wanted to do what I thought was best. That was the way I wanted to show my appreciation. I'm very pleased that I was able to do that. My wife and I started a scholarship fund.
The people that had an impact on your life at Cornell were Dr. Olofsson, of course, and more recently Dr. King, is that right?
Yeah, Dr. John King. Mm-hmm. Dr. King worked with me in assisting my diagnostic work with the research animals that we worked with there, because he was not only an excellent teacher, but he had a good knowledge of subtle changes and came at it from a different approach than the type of education that I had in pathology at the time I was a student. He was an excellent teacher.
And you have a son who's a veterinarian?
My son's a veterinarian. He's just still practicing. He had a partnership in Middleport here. Strictly now, he does strictly cattle and horses, mostly cattle. As a matter of fact, his hobby is beef cattle, and he has a big herd of scimitals. Him and his wife take care of it. He did it for the love of the work. He was like me. If you love a type of work you're doing, it's a pleasure, every bit of it is. And I think I instilled that in his way of thinking.
When I traveled with you, some you had some real close calls over in Burma and Indochina. Any of them that stand out in your mind? Were you said that the Japanese were sometimes only 30, 40 feet, sometimes a few hundred yards away.
Lots of them.
And you were very lucky. You never got injured.
No, I was fortunate. I had a hand grenade land right next to me, but fortunately it was a dud and never went off. I had some coast calls being transported from one column to another in one of these little L1s being fired on. Those little L1 planes. When you're in the general area, the Japs were usually on one side of the trail and you were on the other side. And I walked out one night into the column of the Japanese, actually was in eyesight of them, and they never fired at me and I never fired at them and got back. It was after dark during the nighttime. It was quite a problem with identifying your own troops, and this one veteran, unfortunately, during the night. His assistant got out, the foxhole was urinating. When he came back in, he fired at him and she killed him. So those accidents that happen. It happens more than you realize. So it's a dangerous place to be. We didn't have any artillery at the time. We finally dropped some artillery pieces, pack artillery, and were able then to make a much better headway, because that artillery is a big, big help. All we had before that was mortars. You're fighting against an opponent that's got artillery, you're at a big disadvantage.
A few years ago, you went back over there for a revisit, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, and you had quite
Well, at the 50th anniversary of the campaign, the Burmese government invited, I think, about 25 of us back to as their guest. And they took us around in their old airplanes, the same ones they used during combat. They were German planes, Fokkers. Still were using them, and they flew us over the old area. Most of the places they took us to were places where we'd been campaigning against the Japs. And they treated us really well. They gave us banquets and plenty of food. And they were very cordial, but they were looking out for support of the U.S. They're still having that problem over there. The communists are still trying to take everything over. Anything else?
I don't. I think you've covered it very well, and very nice interview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.